Nikki.
Hi there, this is Thomas again.
Perfect timing. Thank you for understanding. Sorry, it was, you know, it's not a perfect world.
Oh, no. I have 2-year-old twin boys.
Oh.
And so I'm more than aware of that. In fact, I should tell you, if you happen to hear screaming at any point, I've asked my wife to try and entertain them somehow. But if that happens, then I'm really sorry. But hopefully they won't be picked up too bad.
Thank you. And I get it. Well, good for you. Well, how old are they?
2 years old.
Oh, my goodness sakes. You are a gem to deal with that. So,
well, listen, my wife is even more of a gem.
I am all yours. Fire away. This is real special. Thank you for your role in it.
Okay, you bet. It is a special process. And I think the first thing, I guess, would be to ask, how did you get into swimming? I've read some of I've read your biographical material, but I think it would be certainly of interest to the public as they do this.
And it's important, and this is kind of a joke within our community, the difference between swimming and diving is very big.
Sure.
And so when divers get called swimmers, their backs always perk up. So.
Sure. Well, I'm sorry about making that mistake.
No, I'm teasing. I'm really teasing, but... in the, just for the record, internationally, swimming, diving, water polo, and synchronized swimming are governed by the same body. In other words, that's an umbrella organization. It's called FINA, the International Aquatics Association, Federation. But in this country, we're autonomous. So swimming is its own boss, diving its own boss, et cetera. But we are connected. But it's easy to put us all in the same boat, and we're in way different boats, all four of us. So,
sure.
So I got into diving very simply because swimming was boring, and swimming in the pool was boring. I found swimming in the lakes, growing up in Michigan, the land of lakes, if you will, that all summer – lakes were a blast. You know, they were, you know, we had all sorts of games in the lake. You know, we sunk an old rowboat one year and pretended there was hidden treasure in it, you know, and did free diving to go get the treasure. And we chased fish amongst the seaweed. And, you know, we hid stuff, you know, in different parts of the bottom of the lake from our buddies and told them to find it and gave, I mean, you know, lakes were a blast, but In the winter, there was a local Y that had an indoor pool, and in the 50s, that was way something else to have an indoor pool. And I must have drove my folks crazy, and they found, you know, during the winter months, they found this indoor pool at the YMCA that had girls at night 2 times a week, and the girls could use the pool. So I'll never forget the first time I had a chance to go to an indoor pool. I was so excited, and I thought it was just over the top, unbelievable that I could be swimming in the winter, you know. And I remember having to take a shower before I went in the water, like thinking, whoa, you know. And I remember very vividly as I opened the door from the shower room to the pool that I was almost knocked over by the aroma of the indoor pool, which was like heavy chlorine, and thinking, wow, you know, I mean, all these kind of awkward negative things were happening to me before I went into this wonderful thing called swimming in the winter. And then when I got the door all the way open and I saw this pool that was so antiseptic, you know, I mean, just perfectly clean. There wasn't a seaweed growing in the pool. There wasn't sand to sink your feet in. There wasn't a fish to be seen. You could see the bottom of the pool, and it was just boring with a capital B. And so the only fun part of an indoor pool was the diving board. And that's exactly how I ended up. The diving board was the magnet for me to have fun during the winter. Otherwise, a pool was boring. And that clearly, at age 10, I discovered the diving board. And at age 15, I entered my first diving meet. And that's way different than now. You know, you can't enter your first diving meet at age 15 anymore. I mean, they've got an 8 and under age group, you know, for diving. So,
sure.
So now I'm playing at diving, and it said that in that I think in that video, you know, that I it was just a fun game until the high school diver had a part-time job there as lifeguard during the open swim, and when he saw us kids playing around the board, just joking, you know, flip and a half kind of stuff, he started giving us pointers, you know, and hey, don't do this, and do this more, and do that more, and he told us that the old swimming hole jackknife, you know, well, that dive is really a front dive pike position. And I remember going home and telling my folks, I did a front dive pike today, you know. Now I'm talking the real diving language, you know. So it was this, you know, it's like right place, right time. You know, this young kid kind of took us, real kids, I mean, this high school kid took us, you know, age group, little kids, under his wing and started teaching us. Well, and that's from there it grew. I mean, it literally at my first competition was a YMCA meet. When I was 15, and my last competition was Olympic Games when I was 28. And that's the long and short of Mickey's start and end.
Sure. Well, then as you, I guess, grew older, I know that you went to the University of Michigan and dove there. How did that come about?
No, that's because another story. Because again, we're talking in the 60s now, early 60s. I graduated high school in 62, and I had all my friends that I hung with were going to Michigan State, and that was the party school, that was the fun school, that was, you know, the school of choice. The only people that went to Michigan were the eggheads, you know, the real smart ones, and so 25 people are going to the state, and 5 people were going to Michigan. But mm-hmm. Michigan was the school that had the coach, the diving coach. And Michigan State had a great pool, but they didn't have a renowned coach. And my folks said, you know, if you're into this diving thing and you think, you know, that you're going to state because they got a cool pool, that's not good enough. And so they actually talked me into going to the University of Michigan. Because my heart was more than a little serious about getting good at diving. And that, you know, was their guidance that aimed me that direction.
Sure. Well, tell me then how the training for 68 began. How did you end up being selected? How did you, why did you choose to compete? Were you in the Air Force at the time? So there's a bunch to get us to 68.
Yes, there is a bunch, because I go to college in 62, and I'm going to actually back up in 1960. Remember, I was 16. I had been playing with diving and going to these meets from from 15. So at 16, a year later, the Olympic, it's 1960, and the Olympic trials in 1960 were at Brennan Pools in Detroit, Michigan, and that's like less than an hour from where I live, like 50 minutes from where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no rule. They had no qualification rules for trying out for the Olympics. So I literally tried out for the 1960 Olympic Games because, the trials were almost in my hometown. And the family joke is, well, Mickey didn't get last in the 60 trials. I was 29th out of 30. And so, but I got fired up because I was seeing these other people who were the real deal. You know, I was finally seeing real divers, and I said, you know, I can do that. And that's where I got a lead on coaches and where I could find out, you know, where the coaches, where I could get my best coaching. And that's where I heard about this guy that was up at University of Michigan.
Gotcha.
So then I go to Michigan. That was 60, and then 64, I'm a junior at Michigan, and I try out again. And that time the trials were in New York, And I ended up fifth in those trials, and they took three. So I missed my chance then. But, again, I wasn't ready in 60, and I really wasn't ready in 64 either. But now I'm graduating in 1966, and that's 2 years before the Olympics. And, by the way, my folks, you know, in the meantime are saying, hey, you know, we're sending you to college. There wasn't any girls' team, by the way. I think that's important to note because – I was a pre-Title IX-er. I was one of the reasons we needed to have a Title IX. You know, I was, you know, the product of making the big dance without the help from, you know, any other source but my parents, whereas my male counterparts were getting scholarships. So my folks said, hey, you know, 66, you're graduating, you're off the payroll. You know, my sister's 4 years younger, is getting that money that sent you to college, is going to now send her to college. So I had to take care of my, suddenly, you know, take care of myself and be independent from my parents 2 years before the Olympic Games. And that actually was what motivated me to do the Air Force. By accident, got a lead on the Air Force idea and looked into it, and they told me they could give me a meaningful, challenging career and at the same time continue my diving ambitions. And, by the way, in that day and age, the U.S. military was one of the few places in the world that a woman could get equal pay for equal work. And when I tell them, women that this today, you know, today's young gal, you know, whoa, you know, you could work side by side someone in the factory and get less than they do? Yes, you know. I went into the Air Force, and the Air Force stationed me in the ROTC detachment at the University of Michigan. So I had my job. I worked for the Air Force ROTC, normal work hours. Spent my lunch hour at the pool training, and then after work did my second workout right there on campus with my college coach. So that's how I got the Air Force came into my life. And then in 1968, I'm a lieutenant, and I train and I try out for the 68 team. So now I've tried out for 60, 64, and 68. And make it in 68. I make that team. They took two. I can't remember if I was second or first in that trials, but I make the team as a lieutenant in 68, 2 years after I graduated, with the help of the Air Force. And I think that gets us to 68.
Gotcha. And were you concerned at any of the altitude conditions? Was your training than what you'd been doing before?
You know, I have to say that the altitude was a zero factor for my sport. Only if we let it, you know, between our ears. We're not an endurance sport. We're a quick twitch sport. And the swimmers are in a whole nother place. You know, the gymnasts, anybody with stamina, I mean, even fencers who have the stamina of having to have, you know, like 8 minute bouts or something before they get a rest. I mean, they were affected by the altitude, but we were not. But I have to say, we did train at altitude with the swim team, and that was actually a blast that we were able to share that training with the swimmers because, you know, the divers were boring. You know, I knew all the divers, but the swimmers were interesting and fun and had varied backgrounds and had stories. And, you know, so the altitude training we did as divers was in Colorado Springs. And by the way, you know, that's at the Air Force Academy. And my being a lieutenant, then I was right in my own environment there, you know, at the academy. So altitude training was a non-issue, except that at the Air Force Academy was at altitude, was also the most up-to-date, the best Olympic pool in the U.S. So we were at altitude. We'd have gone there whether it was altitude or not because of the facility.
Gotcha. And what were your accommodations like in Mexico City? Were they nice? Were they different? Were you worried about food?
I don't ever remember about worrying about food. And I'll tell you what was interesting about the rooms in Mexico is that all of us roomed together. We had like an apartment, and all the women divers lived in the same apartment, which was way awkward and way, because, by the way, you know, I'm trying to beat my teammates, you know, and hanging around with them is hard in a way. And we weren't like bosom buddies. Every one of us came from a different team with coaches that were alpha males. I mean, you know, they were all trying to beat each other, and all those coaches were trying to one-up each other. And I mean, one of them was from Michigan, my coach. One of them was from Indiana, and the other coach was from Michigan, Indiana. Well, I brought my coach with me. He didn't make the formal team. Well, the other gal, she was just accepting whatever coaching she got. She was from Princeton, New Jersey. So, you know, we just weren't buddies. So here we are in a apartment situation. And, you know, you want to go to bed at, you know, 9. They want to go to bed at 11, you know. You wanted to go eat at 6. They wanted to go eat at 8. So, you know, they're getting up to leave when you're trying to rest. You know, I mean, so it was awkward.
Sure. And was there anybody there that you became particularly close to that wasn't maybe among the group in your apartment?
Not on my team. my hobby was photography, and I wanted to see every venue. I wanted to have pictures of every Olympic event. I wanted to capture all my teammates, you know, and like I wanted to capture Bob Segrin jumping, you know, doing the pole vault, you know.
Sure.
On my camera, you know. So I made it a point to go out and meet every possible Olympian. And so I have to say I know a lot of Olympians, but I don't know that I was close, you know, to anybody.
Right.
Certainly not my diving teammates, because we were, I mean, there were three of us made the team that year, okay? And there are three medals, right? And we were so good. Our team was so much better. There was no doubt that the three American girls were going to get first, second, and third. The only doubt was who was going to be first, second, and third, you know, of us. We had, that was where the competition came in. You know, I wanted to beat those girls, you know. And I didn't want them to know, you know, that if I was having a bad night or, you know, I didn't want to be around them.
Right.
So, I didn't get close to anybody that way, yeah.
Gotcha. Well, what was the most meaningful part then of the games for you? Was it, did you go through the opening ceremonies? Was it, I know it couldn't have been the broken arm that you had, but was there anything that struck you as particularly wonderful about the games?
Oh, you know what? Anybody that isn't bowled over and totally snowed by their first Olympic games hasn't got a heart, you know. Their blood's not pumping. I had kind of a really tragic accident, you know, that stole the medal away from me for my own stupidity. But that, of my two Olympics, because I came back in 72 and actually won the medal I didn't get, of the two Olympics, I mean, Mexico is the one that stands out most vividly and most special. And the reason for that is that the adventure, the color, the sharing the experience, you know, of the first Olympics is irreplaceable. You know, I've never really talked to anybody that's done multiple Olympics about, hey, was your third Olympics as cool as your first, you know? I'm venturing to say that the first Olympics is the one that you remember the most, that makes the most impression on you. And so it's my favorite Olympics in a lot of ways. And I'll tell you exactly why. Because by the time I got to my second Olympics, I'm in a whole nother frame of mind, you know. I never went to Mexico thinking I'd go to another Olympics. That was my only, I mean, I'm 24 years old, I'm a lieutenant, I'm graduated, I got my life to get on with. And you know, at the time, we're training on our own. We didn't have Olympic Training Center that, take care of us and stuff. So we had to get on with our life. This was a temporary thing. We weren't pros, you know. So it never occurred to me to do two Olympics. And so this was it. I was going to absorb it all. And the color, the pageantry was just over the top and special. And after my experience in my event, I went home and took 30 days leave and went back to my hometown in Michigan and moped around and kicked the cat and, you know, was basically depressed. And my father said to me one day, you know, he pulled me aside and he said, it breaks my heart to see you so sad and to have your Olympic experience be so horrible. And he said, I just wish, you know, you'd had some fun while you were there so you could fall back on that. And I said, well, Dad, I mean, I had fun. I mean, gosh, the Olympics, you know, the opening ceremonies was stunning and the camaraderie in the village was just fun as could be. And, you know, they had all sorts of international games and places you could go. I said, yeah, but I had fun at the Olympics. And he said, oh, really? He said, well, then I guess it would have been nice if you'd have just met some interesting people or something, you know, to make your Olympic experience a positive one. I said, come on, Dad. He said, of course I met interesting people. I mean, gosh, I met people from Japan. I mean, have you ever met anybody from Japan, Dad? And I met people from Russia, and they're the bad guys. But these people I met from Russia, they weren't bad. And then I realized, you know, where he was headed. And I said, what are you getting at, Dad? He said, Nick, 5,000 of the world's greatest athletes were in Mexico City, and you were one of them. He said, maybe that's what you were supposed to take away from the 1968 Olympic Games. You know, the fact that you didn't get a medal is a side story. The story is you made the team, and you were one of the best athletes in the world that 2 weeks. You know, that's what I think you should be embracing. And you should stop kicking Fido and start appreciating the good part of your experience. And, you know, no one likes to, you know, to admit that their dad's right, you know. But that made the point, you know. That actually helped me, you know, take a deep breath and say, wow, you know. And that I did appreciate it. And I did have fun. And I met some fabulous people. And I met, you know, people from all, you know, so the answer is, you know, that's what I remember about the games, that way overcomes the oops of the actual event.
Gotcha. You know, there was something particularly, well, all of it I thought was very meaningful, but particularly for me, I do research in the Cold War, and of course 68 is the height of the Cold War.
Right.
And you mentioned you met some people from the Soviet bloc. What was your more specific memory of that experience? You mentioned they didn't come across as Darth Vader.
Right.
But talk a little bit more.
Okay. Give me 2 seconds. I'll let my cat out. Just a minute.
Sure.
Well, here's a very cool story. Very special. We're on the diving platform and we're sharing the workout with the divers from Russia. And of course, they're the bad guys. And we're talking, you're right, they're the bad guys. And here we're at the Olympic Games and we're sharing, you know, we have to take turns, you go, me go, you go, me go. And So some of the buoy divers, one of the buoy divers on the U.S. team, while he was waiting his turn, thought he'd have some fun. And he went up to one of the male Russian divers in English with a smile on his face and a upbeat tone in his voice and, you know, kind of like being a buddy. Went right to this male diver and said, "Hey, man, you know, I hear your mother wears combat boots," and we're all horrified that he said it. But then we realized, well, the Russian guy doesn't know what he's saying. So the other guys in the team kind of laughed and, you know, were playing along with him. And later they were talking about, those Russian dudes, I mean, they're not tough. And, it was kind of ugly. You know, we were taking advantage of the fact that we're in an environment where, they were equal with us. So, and I didn't say anything. I'm older than they are, than our team, by the way, at 24. And I said, what do I do? I guess it's harmless, you know. So one day I went back to the village and realized I forgot something, shampoo or something, in the pool. At the pool, I had to go back to my locker at the pool to pick up something. I left. I go walking into the women's locker room at the pool, and there is the female Russian diver who had stayed late to work out extra. And she was in the locker room, and so I went to my locker, and I acknowledged, and I gave her a hi and a nod or whatever. And I went to my locker and reached in, and as I was, reaching for my missing item, she said in perfect English, "The boys in your team are being a little bit mean." And I just about pooped my pants, Perfect English, with a British accent, actually. And I turned around real slow, and I looked at her, and I said, "I am so sorry. I said, I am so embarrassed for them. Can you forgive them and me for, I don't know what else to say." And she let down and she laughed. She said, "Well, I thought it was kind of funny." She said, "Especially it was funny for me because they had no idea that I knew what they were saying. So I actually had it over them, And from that time on, she and I became buddies. And I said something like, "Well, what time's your workout tomorrow, And she said, "Whatever, whatever." And I said, "Well, I'll see you then." She said, "Oh, please, please don't talk to me tomorrow when you see me." And I looked at her real funny and I said, "Excuse me?" She said, "We have people on the team watching us and we're not permitted to talk with anybody outside our own Soviet bloc." And I said, "KGB, And she said, "Yes." And she said, "There is an officer with every team. And I must be careful because they're watching us at all times." And I said, "Oh, then I promise." So what we did is we made an agreement to meet at the pool every night at the same time when she said they're all eating and they don't, they know if I don't choose to eat that's okay. They don't watch me, so I can meet you down here. So we would meet evenings and just talk about our lives and our countries and our things and what we liked and what we didn't like and whatever, whatever. And so I made a friend, a Russian friend. And that gal ended up getting second on the 10-meter tower, I think. And she was a way long shot. And I guess we could look up who got second or third, whatever the Russian gal was. And so she suddenly became a national hero over there. And was way, I think part of the reason she got a medal was because our diver, Leslie Bush, who won our trials, ended up blowing a dive like for twos and dropped out of the top. She would have been a shoe-in for the top three. When she dropped out, then it gave, space for others to come up, So whatever the reason, this gal now is, all world in her country. And when I met her after the thing and gave her a hug and congratulated her, she said, you know, this will help my family back home. I will get extra rations. And she said, this is so important for me. You know, and I remember thinking, God, you know, that the medal is life to her, you know, literally better standard of life, you know, and that made the impression on me. But anyway, after when she was about to leave, the games were winding up, and we met for the last time, she gave me a bottle of Russian vodka to take home as a gift. I mean, you know, serious vodka. And I didn't have a gift for her. You know, I mean, it was, whoa, it threw me back. I said, oh, I have, she said, no, I have, this is not to be, I just want you to know how special it is that I found you and that I have someone I can share and be honest and open with because I cannot be this way, you know, in my home country. And I said, well, we will make a pact to meet in 1972, because by this time, you know, I'd had my accident, and now, you know, and I had no intention of going to 72. I was still walking around with a cast in my hand. I had no idea what my, you know, life would be, but anyway, that's how that left, and she, you know, so that was my memory of having, you know, finding out that she's a normal person, that she's persecuted back home, that the athletes are treated, you know, like soldiers until they make that grade and get, you know, rewarded, and then they get their status upped and all of that. Now, that each team had a policeman watching the team so they didn't get chummy. You know, all of that was very interesting, I thought.
Oh, very interesting. That's a wonderful story. As in terms of the other larger issues going on at the time, the 68 games were unique for a variety of perspectives, and I thought we might go through these. They were the first to have controls for doping. The Black Power salute, of course. The first games in Latin America. Were you aware of these, any in particular, and to what degree did they affect your experience in Mexico City?
I was aware of the doping. And we were doped too, even though we don't have the same issues as swimmers would be. And since we were so close to the swimmers, and the reason we were close to swimmers, by close, I mean we were buddies with them. We'd kind of time our eating dinner and stuff so we'd eat with them because we got to know them in the Colorado Springs training camp. And they were the ones, they were the ones that got screwed big time by the Eastern team in the 64 games, you know, by East Germany in the 64 games. And so, you know, they were anxious, and I think hopefully you'll find that they didn't mind being trusted because then they knew, you know, that their medals, you know, were clean and stuff. So I can't remember. It seems to me, I know I was drug tested, and I have a very poignant story about my drug testing in 72, which is not your topic, but
We're happy to hear it. It's this is a particular. I literally wrote a book on doping in the Olympics. It'd be wonderful to hear.
Okay, because it's to me it's quite poignant that story. But to finish up, the doping part. I think from what I remember in most cases, I mean, it was a burden, it was inconvenient, but I think in the end, we were glad for it. At least the people I hung around with and I was aware or had conversations with about it. The Black Power, you know, I guess what really struck me when all this happened, and then they were banned from the village and all that, was I had no idea that the track team actually had segregated workouts. And for all my admiration of the track athletes, and, you know, secretly I had a crush on, I can't remember what was Segrin, was he a 68er or a 72er? Bob Segrin, the pole vaulter.
I want to say
72.
Wait, or was it 72?
Yeah, I don't know. He was on one team, but I had this crush on him. I remember that. And the track athletes were so in shape and so represented. They were the gods along with the swimmers, you know. But swimmers for me were people I knew. The track people I didn't know, you know. So they were more of interest, and I really, you know, wanted to get to know them. But to think that those guys I was admiring, those track folks I thought I admired, literally shunned the black athlete, didn't even train with them in training camp, you know, had segregated training camp. That was abhorrent to me, and really took the wind out of my, it took my respect for those athletes and those coaches, you know, to the lowest depths. And then I found out about that, you know, that's why, how naive I was. And I felt cheated that not know, because I think I would have, you know, I was enough that I would have said stuff. And I would have said, what the hell? You know, I'd have been a lot more vocal and stuff. To people, I, you know, I mean, I remember being, feeling that it was hidden, that it wasn't, that I didn't know, that was going on and I didn't know. I was naively, you know, dancing around thinking things were hunky-dory. The U.S. team's cool when it wasn't. That was my feeling of that. And then the last thing was of those three was what?
That these were the first games in Latin America.
Yeah, you know, I had studied Spanish in high school, a little bit in college, and I was excited to go down there and try out my cómo está, you know, and I was aware of how important it was, and it made making that 68 team a little more dramatic, you know, a little more elite, that we're in a place that's brand new to the Olympics, and I can say that, you know. So, yeah, I was aware of it because I couldn't wait to try out my feeble attempt at the language, and I was proud to be part of something that was history-making.
Gotcha. Well, if it's not too painful to talk about, and please feel free to decline. Can you tell me about what happened on, was it the ninth dive?
Yeah, I can. And, you know, I'm way over it. And in the end, it makes for a great story. And maybe had I not won the medal in 72, it would be a whole different thing for me. But, you know, I ended up having, my story has a happy ending, you know.
Sure.
And so I'm, you know, way beyond, you know, that. People say, oh, well, you know, you could have had two medals, you know, if you hadn't done that. And I'm not convinced I would have tried out again. I'm not convinced I would have gone for another team. That I will never know that, you know. So, you know, don't tell me, hey, if I had not done that, I'd have had two Olympic medals, you know. You know, remember that we had the three of us, and we all had a chance at a medal. There were six of us. Now that I think of it, there were three on tower and three on springboard. And the six of us were living in that apartment. That's part of why it was crazy. Remember I told you that all the divers, there's two events, and I just had and we were all from these coaches that were enemies of each other because they wanted to beat each other so bad. So,
sure.
Anyway, we have to sort out who's going to, of the three of us, who's going to win first, second, third, because there was no doubt we were going to go 1, 2, 3. And as we got and watched the warm-ups and stuff, it was clear we were going to go 1, 2, 3, that there wasn't that much competition. But we did realize that there was this gal, Ingrid Kramer from Germany, was actually, we had heard about her and hadn't really seen her. Again, you know, it wasn't, in those days you didn't get the videos and whatnot, and you just heard, you know, results. And she turned out to be a little more formidable. She had a couple dives we thought were better than we thought they were going to be. And so she became a little bit of a concern. But in the end, I was trying to beat those other gals. So we get through the competition, and we had to do five dives in the prelims, and then five dives again. They're called required dives, and they were the front. They're the jackknife, the swan dive, you know, the back. They were the preliminaries. And they had a degree of difficulty of 1.6, 1.7, you know, when the optional dives have degree of difficulty 2.4, 2.5, you know. So these are the easy dives. And everybody could do the easy dives. So it was, you know, kind of a jockeying for position after the first five dives. And after the first five dives, I was comfortably in first place. And I felt I was having fun in Mexico. You know, I was enjoying taking those photos. I got out of that apartment by using my camera to do other things, and making a point not to, quote, hang around with them after the practices were over. And so after that prelims, you know, I'm in first going into the finals, and I'm in control. And I had actually, it was 7 and 3. That was it. We had to do five required dives and two optionals. And I had put my two easy optionals in the prelims and got them out of the way. So I had, you know, three pretty tricky, if you will, but, you know, comfortable dives. Are you still there?
I'm still here. Yeah.
Okay.
You faded out just to hear for a second, and then you're back.
Okay. I don't know if, yeah. So, going into the finals, I had three dives that I'd won meets with, and then I had put them in the right order, the order I'd always won. I was uncomfortable. I was in the lead. So, you know, it was, you know, I mean, I'm nervous, but a positive nervous, and I did my first dive. It was a little short, but it was still comfortable, and I'm leading and feeling great. Now I'm down. I got two dives left. Gosh, I'm in the Olympic Games. And the second to last dive, the reverse 1.5 layout, it's a high degree of difficulty dive, and the layout position is what, because you rotate slower in layout. And I have to admit, you know, I won some dives with that, but I also lost some dives with that meet. So of the three I had left, it was my riskiest dive, if you would. But it wasn't like I was afraid of it or, you know, it was just, I mean, I did it for years. So here we are in the big dance doing it. And as I walked out in my hurdle, I was tentative in my approach, you know, the steps forward. The dive is a walk forward, but when you leave the board, you do the dive back toward the board. That's called the reverse. So forward takeoff, but the action of the somersault is back toward the board. So here I am going back toward the board in layout position. So my body is no bend at the knee, no bend at the waist. And because I'd been tentative, and I don't know, don't ask me why. I mean, why do you, you know, hiccup? I mean, I don't know. I just wasn't aggressive in my hurdle. I think, to tell you the truth, I was afraid of leaning forward. If you lean forward on this dive at the end of the board, then you can't go back. You know, if your weight's going out, you can't do that reverse action very well because you have to, you know, recover from leaning forward to go backward. And I was afraid of leaning forward, and so I overreacted and got back too far. So now if I'm back at the end of the board landing, that put me close. And I guess I just didn't know how close I was. I was surprised when I hit. I wasn't shocked, but I was surprised when I hit. I didn't think I was in that much trouble when I left the board. But that dive didn't knock me out of the competition. I didn't fall apart on that dive. Only of the seven judges, only a couple of them realized I hit. You know, the judges were kind of far away. They couldn't hear the hit on the board. And so that dive, it knocked me down. I think I might have been in second after that dive. But that dive didn't – I'm still in the hunt, and I got my best dive left. I've got my highest degree of difficulty dive and the dive that's – you know, it's my trademark dive. I was the only – I think I'm the only one doing this dive in the meet. Maybe that Russian girl did it too. But I get out of the water and realized that even though I hit, it didn't kill me. You know, it didn't take me. It didn't knock me into the cellar. And so Coach pulled me aside and said, "Hey, you know, we can do this." I mean, he gave me the pep talk. You know, he gave me the talk. Hey, by the way, this is the Olympic Games. You know, you suck it up. You know, if your arm hurts a little, you know. Knock it off. And a trainer came up and offered to give me smelling salts because, you know, I actually went into shock a little bit. It was way cold in that pool anyway, and it's a big cavernous pool, and you're wet, you know, and any you know, air in there made you cold. And then I hit my hand, so they gave me smelling salts. I remember thinking my hair was going to blow off the top of my head. I smelled those smelling salts. And then they looked at my arm, and I had a gash in my arm. And they said, well, here, let's get a bandage. Let's get that bandage up. And I said, wait, no way am I going to put a bandage on that and let people see that I – because they had a clean deck rule. There wasn't athletes hanging around, so nobody knew I hit, really. A couple of judges, but it wasn't a common thing that I hit. I put a bandage on my arm. I'm telegraphing that I'm hurt. And, you know, if I'm the other divers and I see the big winner hurt, then I'm thinking, hey, I got a chance. And I didn't want anybody to have that edge on me. So I said, no way. I'm not putting a bandage on my arm, you know. I had about 5 or 6, maybe 7 minutes, 10 minutes max in between dives before it was my turn again. And Coach said all the right things. The only thing he didn't say right was, the last dive I did was also a reverse action dive. It was a reverse 1.5 somersault with 1.5 twists. So I was doing that same walk out forward and doing the action back toward the board that I just hit on. But it wasn't as scary a dive as the one I actually hit on. So that was least of a worry. But Coach kept telling me, just hit my hurdle, get to the right end of the board, don't lean. You know, he's telling me all that. The thing that he should have told me that he didn't, because I was hyped for this. I was not thinking about my broken arm. I didn't know it was broken, by the way. I was not thinking about my hurt arm. I wasn't thinking about hitting. He got me thinking about the dive I was doing. And that was the right thing. But what happened when I went up in the air, he said to me, and when you go to wrap for the twist, that arm you just hit on the board is going to hurt like hell. You know, be prepared for that arm to hurt when you twist. Then I would have been kind of waiting for it. But instead, I was thinking about landing the hurdle right. I was thinking about leaving the board without leaning. I was thinking about other things. And when I wrapped for the twist, suddenly out of nowhere, I had this, like, strike of lightning hit me that I wasn't prepared for because I forgot to think about the fact that I just hurt my arm and it might hurt more when I put it back in action. So as soon as that pain hit me, and if you see the movies, it's like I suddenly fell apart. You know, I did the spaghetti dive. That's when I dropped, you know, the big scores, because that dive was a abomination, and I totally fell apart on the last dive. That's the dive that knocked me out. So I moved from first or second down to fourth, and of course there's only 3 medals.
Oh, that's tough. That's tough to just hear about.
Yeah.
And I guess how did you? Did it immediately destroy the games for you? I know that talking about your father and sitting and finally finding some peace with it. But what happened after that?
No, it didn't. That I'll tell you what destroyed it is within minutes, it seemed like. And again, you know, historians might be able to go back and give a timeline, but it was not long before the end of the meet that, and in some Olympics, you come back the next night, you know, and you get awarded your medal. There, you got awarded that same night within, you know, 20 minutes of the event being over. And I remember it all happening so fast, you know, that my dive's over, the meet's over, they announce the winners, and then they start parading out for the first, second, and third to get their awards. And I remember it all being like it was a snap. And before I knew it, I'm watching someone else get my medal, you know. And remember, it was supposed to be 1, 2, 3, USA, USA, USA. And suddenly, yeah, it's USA first, and we got split by that German girl. And then we got first and third. And I'm fourth standing watching this parade of winners. And it hit me like, you know, what just happened? You know, like the badge, okay, I'll wake up now. And of course everybody came over to me and they, you know, comforted me and all of that they took me the next day. I mean, my arm hurt and it throbbed, and it wasn't until the next day I went to the doctor and found out, hey, that's got a fracture, that's a fractured arm. And I got the cast put on, and then I became, so everybody's, ooh, can I sign your cast? So it became I signed Mickey's cast. You know, it was, people were making it a fun novelty, and it took the sting out of it while I was at the rest of the games. You know, now I'm free to be a spectator. I'm free to take all those pictures and go to all those events because my event's over. And oh, by the way, when I show up, everybody's, oh, there's Nikki. She's the one that got hurt. Hey, let's sign her cast, you know. It's a very famous cast. By the way, it's in the Swimming Hall of Fame down in Fort Lauderdale, the International Swimming and Diving Hall of Fame, with all these famous signatures on it. But
very cool.
So that it wasn't until I got home with the cast on my arm where I'm no longer, you know, people don't get it. They don't recognize me. They, you know, I'm not. You know, now I am the loser, you know, I'm fourth. That's when it hit me and I was in that depressed, you know, woe is me, you know, how bad am I kind of state. The rest of the Olympic Games, I was running around like, you know, like the Queen of Sheba, because people were sympathetic and sought me out to hug me and, you know, all of that. It was upbeat, you know, people were being upbeat. But when I got home, that's when it was like the bad news. So the rest of the Olympics, I mean, the 68 games is way, 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 way memorable and way excitingly positive for me.
Gotcha. Well, after you got home, when did you decide that you were going to try again? Or when did you find out that you were going to have the chance to in 72?
Okay.
And I guess what I mean is, what did you end up doing in the Air Force, and how did you get the chance to come back?
Right. And that's kind of a cute story, too. The I spent 30 days, you know, I spent a couple, 3 weeks at home. And then near the end of my leave, I drove up to Ann Arbor and went to see Coach Kimball. And I hadn't really talked to him since I'd been back. He was just hurt for me, you know. He was brokenhearted for me, too, in a way, in the hurtful way, like he knew that what it meant. And he also knew when everybody else was hugging me saying, hey, too bad, you know, he knew it was going to be 4 years before I could try again. And you know, I mean, it's not like the – you know, the World Series, we'll get them next year, you know. It's a four-year wait, you know, and the difference between 24 and 28 years old is big. So I clearly, you know, he was clearly felt the real deal. He knew what I was really up against. But I came back and said, I was able to say to him, I just can't believe it. You know, woe was me, and, you know, I was pitiful, pitying myself. And he says, hey, you know, get off that. He said, let's just start, you know, thinking about that, you know, next go around. And I said, you know, coach, gosh, you know, I'm in the Air Force. They're not going to keep me here in Ann Arbor anymore. I'm committed. They're going to put me off in another assignment. I mean, I can't train. I won't be able to train with you. And I was really afraid of coming back and getting beat by the kids that I was beating. You know, I was the matriarch. I was queen bee. And the idea of coming back and getting beat because I'm old now and I'm not training like I should, and I did not want to be a has-been. And that's what I, like, that's the famous quote. I mean, he said, if you come back, I'll get you ready. And I believed him, but I didn't know how I was going to possibly do that with the Air Force thing and all of that. So I talked to the Air Force, and Coach and I decided, well, what we'll do is we'll work out for the next nationals, and we'll see how we do. Let's just do it one nationals at a time. If you can be in the hunt in a nationals, then you know you're on top of your game, and everybody will know you're back, and, you know, there'll be no questioning that Mickey's still as good as she always was. So let's aim for the nationals in 69. Well, in the meantime, the Air Force says, hey, nice try in 68. By the way, we're stationing you somewhere else. Well, little did I know, you're out of Ann Arbor, girl. Well, little did I know that Coach Kimball had gotten in touch with the Air Force Sports Office and said, you know, I think I can talk her into, I guess what happened, Tom, is I had told him, hey, I'm done. And I'm going to get involved in my Air Force career. I've got a couple more years, for my 4-year commitment. And I just don't see me coming back. And to me, I've still got my cast on. You know, it took me 6 months and all that, you know, to get healed and stuff.
Sure.
So what he did, when they moved me out of Ann Arbor, he intervened without me knowing and got them to station me in a place where I could train once I get out of my cast, if I chose to. And he felt like he could talk me into it, you know. So I suddenly get this assignment in California, which is across the country from Michigan. And I didn't realize, I thought, well, hey, this is a good assignment. Hey, this isn't bad, you know. And I hadn't thought of it that right down the street, you know, was Long Beach, where they had a big pool and a great diving facility and a couple good coaches that I could train. I never thought about that part, but turned out, here's the story. It turned out that the nationals in the winter nationals of 69 were in Long Beach, California, at this wonderful pool. And I go down and watch these, and Coach is there, and all my buddies are there, and all the diving community's there, and I'm sitting in the bleachers watching this nationals. And the old feeling comes back, you know, and I'm watching them dive, and I'm thinking, I can do that, or they gave that a 6, that was a 4, you know. I'm doing all this, you know, mental diving with them, you know, and it was after that meet when I went back to Coach and said, you know, should I or shouldn't I, you know, and that's when he said, if you come back, I'll get you ready. He said, oh, by the way, you know, I got a couple guys down in Long Beach said they'd coach you. And then when you get ready for the next meet, you can come back, take some leave, and train with me, you know, the final 2 weeks before the meet and stuff. So we set the 69 Summer Nationals as my trial. If I, you know, if I could hold my own in that Nationals, then I would know whether to keep trying for 72. And the irony, this is a side irony, but that Nationals was in Louisville, Kentucky. And who would ever thought I'd end up living in, you know, just a short way away from Louisville for 20 years. But anyway, I go back to that Nationals, and I train in California with these new coaches. And when I get to the side of the meet, Kimball coaches me and stuff, and I end up winning two events and getting second in the third at that Nationals. And Coach and I never had a conversation about should I or shouldn't I anymore. It was just assumed that I'd train for that 72 games. So I was stationed out in California all the, between 68 and 72. I took leave and went and trained with him before each Nationals, you know, for, 10 days or something to get, you know, the final polish. You know, won a couple more Nationals with him and then tried out for that 72 team and made that 72 team, went living from California and training out there.
Gotcha. Well, I think we're getting close to wrapping up, but if you could give a piece of advice to one of today's Olympic hopefuls, given all of your experiences and what you had to go through, what would it be?
You know why that's a hard question is, are you Tom or Thomas?
Either one, Thomas.
Okay. Tom, the reason that's a hard question is then and now. I mean, what the kids do now and what the training's like now compared to then. I mean, now you can go to the Olympic Training Center and they'll pay you to train. You know, you can pick any coach in the country and, you know, and they'll pay your way to meets and pay your way to training sessions. And, you know, it was such a different, I mean, and it's way better now, way better. But what's happening is the kids are taking it all for granted. They're not hungry. They didn't have to scrap for what they had. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to think about that question. I mean, basically, the NCAA stuff, now women are diving in college. We never had that outlet. That's a big help. They have a national training center now. I don't know if I'd have left my coach and gone to the training center where they, you know, I don't know. I guess in the end, you know, it's that you have to take a deep breath and concentrate on that goal because you can't have 10 balls in the air and make an Olympic team. You have to have one ball in the air, and that's your training ball to get ready. You know, it's hard to have a social life. It's hard to have a employment life. You know, it's hard to have, another thing going on besides your training. And that's hard for today's kids because there's so much out there for them to, you know, to distract them. I guess I'd have to think about that more. That's the one question you surprised me with that I couldn't answer.
Sure. And we can always talk again, or you can send an email, or you can do an update. We're using software that allows updates, and so there's all sorts of stuff we can do.
Okay.
Is there anything else you can think that is important or would like to tell us? Or
let me tell you that the other part of the story of the drug testing in 72.
Ah, perfect.
I come back in 72 and there's nobody that says, oh, poor Mickey, you know, she had that accident in 68. What a bummer. You know, let's let her win in 72. Let's help her out so she doesn't get screwed again. You know, no one does that, you know. and they're hungry and they're, you know, they want to beat me and they all know my story and they could care less, you know. But I make that team and I'm 28. And by the way, I had a 4-year gig in the Air Force and I extended. Of course, I went in for 4 years and retired 26 years later, you know, because the Air Force turned out to be a really meaningful, challenging career that they promised, you know, and I fell into it and was comfortable in it. So I'm now a captain, and I got stuff to do, you know, and I'm now a little bit more into my job and a little less into training, but in a way, I was just keeping sharp. I wasn't relearning. I wasn't, you know, I had a good blueprint. You know, I had a good foundation. So I make that 72 team, and it was a whole nother set of personalities and a whole nother, you know, the set of dramas. And I went into it with a total 100%, hey, this is my last hurrah. There ain't no, you know, 76 games. I got to make this work. I can't screw this up. So I was all business. I mean, I went around and did pictures, and I got to know people. But, you know, that was after my event. You know, I was, well, I didn't, I talked about the glamour and the pageantry and the adventure of that first games. Uh-uh. I could care less. I wasn't into pageantry, you know. I had business to do. So I was a whole different mindset in 72. And I know that's an aside because you're, you know, it's not about 72. But I'm now 28. They called me Mama Max. You know, my real name's Maxine. I don't know if you knew that. So Mickey's short for Maxine. They called me Mama Max. I'm the old fart on the team. And I'm no nonsense. And, you know, they can go out after and go to the Hofbrauhaus. You know, I'm going to bed, you know. So I get up and I do those. I have the same agenda, same diving order, except I took that reverse one and a half layout out, which had a high degree of difficulty, and put in the reverse one and a half tuck, which was a low DD but a guaranteed hit, you know. And so I never did that dive again after I hit my arm. So, and then I do that last twister and hit it, and wow. You know, I knew when I went down. Someone told me that underwater I went down in the bottom of the pool, and I pounded my fist on the bottom of the pool in celebration. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, so now I have just recovered and won the medal I didn't get, right? And I go up on, and there's some stories about my victory ceremony, and that's enough. I'll tell you that, you know, over a beer sometime or something. But
we're happy to hear it here. It's we don't have to be limited to 68.
Oh, okay. Well, the 72 story is way funny and way cute. If your kiddos aren't raising hell back there, I don't hear them.
I don't hear them. They sound good to me.
true story. When I went back, you know, I did my prelims, and Coach Kimball, when I went, did my first, or before my first dive in the prelims, he gives me this speech, that he gives me the pre-meet speech for the first dive. He says, by the way, he said, you are ready. You know, you couldn't be more ready. And he said, and I'm really excited for what's ahead, he said, but I want you to know that if you're not ahead by 15 points, going into the finals, he said, it's okay, you know, it's going to be okay if you're behind by 2 or 3 points. And I was floored to hear that from him. I mean, he was giving me permission to be behind. And that was never, had never done that. And it shook me up a little bit. And I must say that, you know, by now I, you know, but why would he tell me that? So anyway, I get on with the meet. Sure enough, after the 7 dives, I'm in 3rd place by 3 points. And so that means we're really stacked. 1st, 2nd, and 3rd are real close. And I looked up at the scoreboard, and I'm thinking, S-H-I-T, you know. Just what he told me came true. Why did he, you know, like it was his fault, right? And I came over to him, like, kind of like my hands on my hips saying, you know, what the hell, you know. And I, before I could open my mouth, he grabbed me by the shoulders, and he pointed. He's little, by the way. He's shorter than me. And he turned me around and pointed over to the 2 girls that were in 1st and 2nd in front of me. They happened to be 2 Swedish girls that I knew very well. They actually trained with Kimball, with my coach and me in the summer. So, you know, I knew these 2 girls, and coach had actually made them better divers, and here they were beating me. But anyway, I looked over there, and there they were, both of them, with TV cameras on them and a microphone, you know, and what's his name, Bill Fleming, interviewing him for TV. Well, 72 was the first Olympics that had serious TV. Those 2 Olympic weekends, those 2 weekends at each end of the games. You know, you remember Jim McKay, you know, he had 6 or 7, 8 hours of, you know, Olympics. That's the first time you saw it at home. And Kimball says, you know, You see those two? That's where you'd be right now, explaining and talking about Mexico and talking about what you're going to do this afternoon. You know, to TV, he said, you don't need that. He said, you need to get back to your room and rest and eat and be thinking about this afternoon. I didn't want, I'm not unhappy at all that you're where you are. We know you can beat Ulrika. I looked over there and saw them, and I thought, wow, he's brilliant, you know. That I did not need to do that, and I was, and so I took off, and they were still talking, and I'm, you know, in my room. So I get back, I'm in third place, and but I had my three best dives left, and of course Ulrika had trained with us, and so she knew I had my best dives left, and I knew she knew, and she knew I knew she knew, and that was my ace in the hole, that I had her right where I wanted her, psychologically and physically and dive-wise. So I'm back in my room kind of going through my dives in my head, and we had, you know, a long time. It was, you know, probably 6 or 7 hours. And as I was packing to go back to the pool, I did my routine, you know, of I put in my and by the way, any athlete that tells you they're not superstitious, they're lying to you, okay? And I had my favorite suit, and I had my favorite towel, and I packed my favorite hairbrush, and I'm getting my, you know, my everything all set to go back to the pool. I went to reach for my sweats, and you're required to wear your sweats on the victory stand. You know, they were never the kind of sweats you wore just, you know, around. I mean, because they weren't made for water. You know, when you're wet, they didn't absorb water. So we had, you know, like pool sweats, and then we had the issued sweats that you had to wear on the victory stand, and that's that was a requirement. And so I went to reach for those sweats. True story. And as I was putting it in the bag, I said to myself, "Self, you know, if I put those sweats in there and bring them to the pool with me, you know, I may not need them, you know, meaning I may not make to the podium. So I better leave them here because I want to need them tonight." And that was my exact thought pattern. You know, I'm a college graduate. I'm a smart person, but I talked myself into leaving my sweats there because I wanted to need them at the pool. So I go, so I did it and didn't think anything of it. I go to the pool and I pull off all the dives I'm supposed to. And I did the last dive I did in Munich to win the games was the same dive I did in Mexico that lost the games for me. The dive I did, the spaghetti dive I did with the broken arm. So that's kind of a cool tie together, you know, between those two dives. And I pop out of the water, and Coach Kimball's given me the, you know, the perfect sign, and I win the Olympic Games. And within minutes, they're gathering me up to go get my medal. So I go to reach for my sweatsuit, right? I needed it. Well, where was it? It was in my room. And now I'm required to wear it on the victory stand. So my theory worked. I needed to need it. So it's a good thing I left it. But now I'm in trouble because they're calling me to get in the parade. So I see one of the Olympic teammates, one of the USA boxers, had come to the pool and got on the pool deck somehow, and he was just watching, you know, the event. And he's wearing his warm-up, his USA warm-up as a jacket. And I said, Bubba, hey, man, I need your jacket. I got to go. I'm going on the victory. I don't have mine. And he goes, "My sweatsuit's going to be in the Olympic medals? It's yours, you know." And so I'm wearing Bubba's sweat, you know, USA jacket in my Olympic parade outfit. But I also needed the pants, and I didn't have the pants. And my teammate Janet Eady had just slipped her sweatpants on, and I said, Janet, I need your sweatpants. Girl, I gotta go. I got, you know. And she wasn't in my event. She's a power diver. She said, "Oh, yeah, here they are." So I put on her sweatpants and Bubba's sweat top, and I march out in the parade. And as I march, I'm taking a deep breath. Gosh, I just won the Olympics. Well, man, this is all my whole, the whole universe is caving in on me. What just happened? All the excitement. And in And then as I'm, you know, trying to gather what all is going on, I put my hands in Bubba's pocket of Bubba's sweatpants, and he's got a candy bar in that pocket that's all melted from the hot of the pool. And my fingernails break through the paper, and I got suddenly pull my – I'm walking out there, and I sneak my hand, and I got chocolate, you know, in my in my fingernails of my – while I'm walking out to the awards ceremony. Well, I'm kind of horrified at this, and I'm thinking, well, how am I going to get rid of – I guess I'll rub this off on Janet's sweatpants, you know. And I look down, and I'm going to start to rub the chocolate on her sweatpants, and I look down, and, you know, Janet Ely is easily five inches shorter than me. And I've got her sweatpants on that look like I got high water, you know, pedal pushers on for sweatpants.
Sure.
And here I am in the parade ceremony in Bubba's sweatpants and sweatshirt and Janet's high, you know, really high water sweatpants with fingernails full of chocolate, you know. And people ask me, well, what were you thinking about as you were marching out to get your medal? I'm thinking about, you know, how goofy I look and how stupid I was to leave my sweats in my room because I wanted to need them. But anyway, you know, I get her sweatpants all full of chocolate so I could get my fingernails clean, and they present me with my medal, and it's way, you know, way obviously, you know, and I was thinking about other things because, I mean, you don't, it's just, you're flooded with emotions, it's an incredible, I mean, you can't almost put it into words. So when people say, how did it feel? I mean, that's the most, you know, ignorant question. You can't put how it feels into words. And at the moment, how it feels is in your heart, you know, and in your body. It's not it's not even in your head. So I'm overwhelmed with all this and the anthem and all that. And after we walk off the parade, the first thing they do is they want to take this sample. You know, they want to do the sample of urine. And before they do that, while I'm getting someone tugging me to go give my sample, someone says, you know, look at your medal, it's engraved. Well, the 72 medals were engraved. But you saw that on the tape where they engraved my medal wrong?
Uh-huh.
Did you see that on the... Can I take this for a second?
Uh-huh, you bet.
Listen, this is someone who might be listening.
Sure.
Mickey here? Yeah. Did you make it? You did good. I mean, how long has that been? I guess it's been an hour and a half, hasn't it? Was it a hard trip? Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I am on the phone with someone else I need to get back to. But, Richard, I'm so glad you called. I'm so relieved, and I'm glad all is well. And I got thinking about the kitties won't make you miserable tonight either, so that's another good reason. Too cute. Well, I'll catch you another time and we can talk longer, but I'm so excited about today, and I'm so glad you're back safe, and have a good day tomorrow. Okay, Rich. Catch you. You bet. Bye. Tom, sorry.
Oh, not at all. No problem.
Okay. So anyway, the medal story is very cute because the Germans could not change the medal. They wanted me to change my name instead of changing the medal,
mm-hmm.
Which is a very cute story, I think, and very real. But here's the story I wanted to tell you, and I'll leave you with. By the time all three of us were in the doping room where we had to give a sample of 50 milliliters of urine. And, of course, we're anxious to get this over with and go celebrate. And everybody, they finally came back and told me, hey, Mickey, you know, you're taking too long, so we're gonna be at the Hofbrauhaus. We'll meet you there. You know, we'll get started. We'll save a seat for you. Okay, I'll be there. Well, one by one, the other two girls gave their samples, and I was still the last one. I'm drinking hot tea and everything. And finally, I mean, literally a couple hours later, I finally, you know, able to pee out the required amount, and they released me. And it's flat, it's midnight now. And I walk out of the natatorium and the cool air of the evening hits me. And it was like it seemed like it was a full moon. I remember the moon being stunning. And I remember the cold air kind of hitting me. And I remember being alone out there with the moon and my medal. And I started walking and I said, they're all waiting for me at the Hofbräuhaus. And there's no way I felt in the mood to go to the Hofbräuhaus suddenly. Mm-hmm. You know, that excitement of right after in the pool and everybody tugging at you and everybody congratulating, hugging you. Now suddenly it's hours later and the whole thing just hit me. And I'm in this quiet, in the Olympic Village at midnight in the quiet. Every once in a while you'll hear some loud shouting or something from the dorms and laughing, but it's I'm by myself with nature, and that's when it really struck me. You know what I just did, and you realize what this means, and you know what's ahead for me? How will this change my life? How did I do it? Wow, what a ride, what a journey! And I'm walking toward my room with all these emotions. And I realized, you know, hey, it's midnight and I need to do, I'm going to go into the dining hall and grab something to eat. And I go into the Olympic dining hall that's flat, empty. It's just me. And, you know, one of the cooks, you know, keeping, because it's open 24. And I go in there and I said, hey, they had the make your own ice cream sundae deal, you know, at the Village. And I said, what better way to celebrate my gold medal than an ice cream soda that I make myself, you know, and I put a chocolate and I put the vanilla, you know, and I make this outrageous, you know, and whipped cream up to the ceiling and I'm just enjoying the fun of this and laughing at myself that this is the way I'm celebrating it. But I was so in a zone of comfort and joy, and being by myself was like perfect. And so I sit down at this table in the back of the room, and I sort of in the middle, I guess. And I sit down and I plunk this big old, grossly, obesely, you know, obscene is the word, obscene soda, milkshake thing, right on the table, and I sit down and I kind of rub my hands together like, here I go. And about the time I take my first bite, the door to the dining hall opens and these two big guys come walking in. They're all rowdy and they're kind of leaning on each other and laughing and high-fiving and, you know, and they're speaking English with an accent. And they're coming in, and they don't see me until they get right up close to me, and they stop, and they say, oh, we've got company, mate, you know, can we join you? Do you mind? Hey, we just finished our event today, and we're done, and we're just going to celebrate, and can we join you? And, damn, you know, I was so happy to be alone, you know? I so wanted to be alone and enjoy my Sunday, you know? But these two cute guys, you know, and sure, come on, join me, yeah, sit down, yeah, well, we'll get, and they came back, and they had made plates piled high, and whatever, and they were just laughing, and they were having a ball, and so they said, hey, well, what event, you know, we're weightlifters, what do you do? I said, well, I'm a diver. Oh, diving, that's crazy, you're crazy, you know, hey, all we do is we lift these, you know, and they were talking and laughing and, you know, say, and by the way, he said, you know, my buddy here, he got fifth today, you know, he kicked some real butt, you know, and they're talking with this heavy, they're Australians. So they turn around and say, hey, how'd you do today, you know, and as they were saying it, they looked over, you know, their eyes caught the box. And the box that has the medal, I mean, everybody knows the box. And they suddenly stopped and got quiet. Because, you know, they realized they were talking to someone with a box. And so they turned around and they kind of got real sober. You know, I mean, they weren't drunk, but, I mean, you know, they quieted down from their giddiness. And they looked over and said, they pointed and they said, you know, yours, you know, at the box. I kind of sheepish, and so they, one of them said, do you mind? And I said, no, and they picked it up, and they, one of them picked it up and slowly opened it, because the box, you don't know what's in it, what color is in it, until, and then they saw that it was a gold medal. And, wow, they stopped, and they looked at me, and they didn't even know my name. You know, they didn't know anything except they saw my, you know, I was a USA sweatsuit. And these two guys I never met, didn't know their name, didn't only knew their country because of their sweatsuit. And they stood up and they saluted me and my medal, you know, and then gave me a hug. And then finally one of them smiled and they said, aha, you know, and they reached around, fumbled around, and out of their workout bag they pulled out this huge bottle of wine that, wine or champagne or something, that they were supposed to celebrate with when they won their medal. But they didn't win what I did. And suddenly I realized that I wasn't alone and that I shouldn't be alone. I'm with these two guys that didn't know me, but they knew what I'd done without knowing me. And that celebrating my medal that way was way, way, way more special than getting, going down to my drunk buddies, you know, at the opera house. By the time I got there, would never remembered I had showed up. And I spent that last hour in, you know, that night in the dining hall of the Olympic Village with two Australian weightlifters celebrating my gold medal. And
wow.
And that's, I think, as memorable as it gets in my book about that experience.
That is very special. Wow. Well, is there anything else that you can think of that you'd like to share? That's a pretty high note to drop,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Anything else?
And I guess that 72 story ties in with the 68 story, you know, with the, you know, losing and winning thing. I'd have to think about that. I think our, you know, our training session was in Colorado Springs was special because, you know, we were sharing it with the swimmers, and that expanded our, you know, the personalities we were with. I don't know if anybody's told you in their discussions that while we were at the Air Force Academy, the 1968 Olympic women's swimming and diving team were the first women to ever eat in the dining hall of the Air Force Academy.
Hmm.
That we were invited to eat with the cadets, and that was, you know, real special. Well, it was so special because women were not, it was only a male institution, and so there were no women on the grounds ever. And to have the 68, they were, you know, we were special if they would allow women to eat there. So that's kind of not a big known fact, and I think that's kind of interest.
Sure, absolutely.
You talk to those swimmers, you could ask them, do they remember eating in the dining hall, and do they remember that was, you know, the first time that women were ever allowed to eat in the dining hall? Because the cadets eat every meal as a unit, you know. They don't come in, you know, first session, you know, they all, you know, all 4,000 of them eat at the same time.
Wow.
And they eat served meals. They don't do a cafeteria. Meals are served, so. So that's kind of a cool, I think, something of note for the history books.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Very cool.
You know, they're the first women, really, to swim in the pool and all of that stuff. So.
Right.
So, Tom, I'd have to think about that question. You know, who else have you interviewed from the swimming and diving team? Anybody else?
We have interviewed... Is it just one swimmer, Doug Russell?
Oh, okay.
And I believe he's the only swimmer or diver.
Okay.
That has been among the, we've got, gosh, we're approaching 20 now, but I think the only swimmer or diver.
Okay. All right. Yeah, and I don't remember Doug, you know, specifically with any specific things. But we, so I have to think about that. that question of what I think's been forgotten of memory. I do remember that the pool was not quite even finished yet by the time the games came. You know, the Mexicans had, they were going through war at the time. They had some political unrest.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. And so that distracted some of their abilities of getting, you know, the construction done. So they were still working on the locker rooms and final touches on the pool when we came to practice. By the time the games came, they weren't there, but there were workers on the you know, on the pool deck when we were training, you know, early on to the game. That I think that's another, you know, noted thing. But you know, I was so caught up in that this isn't a living. I mean, I'm from Pontiac, Michigan. I grew up, my dad worked in the factory of General Motors Truck and Coach. I mean, there's not an elite bone in my body, and I'm in Mexico City at the Olympics. I mean, there wasn't much I was criticizing in the negative here, you know.
Right.
And I just say, hey, it'll be ready in time for the opening ceremonies. Well, that's all that was important, you know, and stuff. So.
Sure.
So way, you know, way more. I mean, that, like I said, two Olympics, and the first Olympics is going to trump every Olympics after that, unless, you know, I can't imagine how that wouldn't be the case.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I very much do appreciate you talking to me, and the next step will be, and it may take a month or two because we've got a variety of recordings stacked up, but the next step will be for us to transcribe this, and then we'll send you a copy you to look over, and you'll be able to add things if you'd like to add things, so there'll be more chances.
Okay.
As you have time to reflect.
Yeah.
For us to talk more.
And maybe when I'm in a, you know, reading it in a different location, you know, sitting in quiet, you know, that something will come to me that it didn't before.
Absolutely. Exactly. That's sort of our thought for how this will work.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Well, I'm really excited about what you're doing, and it was a special team. And do you have Dick Fosbury on your list to talk to?
That is on our list to talk to. Yep. Yep. We have everybody actually on our list to talk to, whether or not everybody's willing.
Yeah.
I
guess what I mean, have you been, is he on your, I'm ready to schedule kind of thing?
No, he's not. We're sitting at about 30 that are on our immediate list.
Okay.
And we came to the decision that contacting more people or adding more people to the list right now. We want to get what we've our current small list done before we can move on. And part of that is driven by the semester system. My graduate students will be phasing out, and I'll have a new set of graduate students next semester.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, you need to feel like you've moved forward. You got to cross X out before you start Y, and I can see that once you get that 30, then you can take and say, wow, we just did 30. Now we're on our next set. You know, I think I see your wisdom there.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you have a wonderful evening, and we'll be in touch very shortly with the next step. Okay?
Yeah, that's cool. You're the leader here. There's no hurry at my end. And, you know, I mean, in other words, we're not, you know, judging anything by how quick stuff's happening. We just really respect and appreciate what you're doing.
Well, we very much appreciate that, and thank you. Thank you for the patience, and I do think in the end this is going to be a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I think we're going to actually be the envy of a lot of people because, you know, Tom Lowe being, you know, you need a point guard in this process, and he's been the guy. And not every team has one that's quite as passionate. So I think that, that all that'll evolve as it's supposed to, I guess. So.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks again. Well, enjoy those little cuties of yours. And
I will. Thank you.
And I'll sign off, and we'll just stay in touch as needed.
Okay. Thanks so much, Mickey.
You bet. Bye now.
Bye.